anti-intellectualism is intimately linked with disillusionment in the credo of progress among broad social strata in Europe. To them, the intellect appealed either as an instrument of domination or as an abstract conglomeration of phrases and slogans having no reference to their own concerns. With loss of faith by Europeans in their rationalistic daydreams, wherein their power had seemed to grow without bounds, was given respectability by the anti-liberal literati's devaluation of reason. Hamsun's anti-intellectualism soon became apparent in his attacks on earlier 19th century writers. One of his heroes, called Maupassant, crude and soulless. Footnote 98, text. Tolstoy, a fool in philosophy, who talks twaddle. Footnote 99, text. And Ibsen, a little writing oddity. Footnote 100, text. Who has brought shame upon his country, a land which has engendered nothing but peace conferences, the skiing spirit in Ibsen so far. Footnote 101, text. In 1892, Hamsun already contributed to the authoritarian Führer cult, which cheers at the moral anxieties and compulsions of the intellectual, while arrogantly exalting the morally insensate body beautiful ideal of the racial hero when he joined his contempt for one of Ibsen's more remarkable sayings with an alleged physical weakness of the playwright. The great poet produces a pursed lip expression, praises his chicken breast to the utmost, and delivers himself of the following words. To make poetry is to summon oneself to the day of judgment. Footnote 102, text. Philosophy of life. Hamsun's heroes are querulous in posing the problem of their destiny. The hungry one asks, was the hand of the Lord turned against me? But why just against me? Why, for that matter, not just as well against the man in South America? Footnote 103, text. Page 343. The journalist Lung never finds an answer to his question. Why would not everything be good, and why could not men be happy in life? Footnote 104, text. A lover poses the problem. The other he loved as a slave, as a madman, and as a beggar. Why? As the dust of the road and the leaves that fall, as the mysterious god of life, for there is no other that knows such things. Footnote 105, text. When August the vagabond meets with misfortune, the question is raised. Possibly somewhere away out in the universe there is a great eye which was watching him, a power which in some way or another has learned of the labors of the desperate service of nothing at all. Footnote 106, text. In the end, the answer to all these questions of suffering humanity is invariably surrender, surrender to a sphere of power existing before and beyond all individual existence. Man is not capable of changing it in any way, nor is he entitled to do so. What is life's? All but what is yours? Footnote 107, text. And the answer demonstrates once more the worthlessness of the individual. Life could afford to waste her, to throw her away. Footnote 108, text. That is true of every floundering human being, and every human being is going under. Life is alone. I know no one has not feared as badly as myself. Footnote 109, text. Hamsun again and again gives expression to the passivity and obedience which such inexorability of life requires. While life itself has thrust me away into something hostile to myself. There is no cult which must answer the question, why should life do that? Footnote 110, text. There is only one law life can afford to waste. Footnote 111, text. Hamsun's philosophy of life has a twofold social function. On the one hand, it offers the socially less successful the consolation that their insignificant role in the economic process can be compensated for by the acceptance of the greater metaphysical context of the omnipotence of life. And so it is, the mere grace that we are given life at all is generous payment in advance for all the miseries of life, for every one of them. Now, do you think we have the right to more sweetmeats than we get? Footnote 112, text. Page 344. The individual is to become reconciled to his condition in society by perceiving himself as a necessary sacrifice to a natural process, a sacrifice not merely mechanical but full of meaning. On the other hand, this mythology offers no tangible expectation for alleviating deprivation and disillusionment. The consolation turns against those consoled. They must accept life as it is, and that means the existing relations of domination and subordination, of command and serf. The image of man, Hamsun's mythology, throws new light on his misanthropic contempt. His exalted picture of life stands side by side with the image of crawling and creeping man in the same way that authoritarian propaganda later combined ostensibly lofty notions with expressions of vulgar misanthropy. A metaphysics of the miserableness of a man is mobilized against the idea of human progress. Every desire for a more rational organization of society becomes incongruous. It is significant that Hamsun uses the analogy of the anthill, so popular in liberal reformist literature as a model of constructive social order, as an image of planlessness. But that made no difference to the town. The town remained the little crawling anthill it was, and this is itself must have been a proof that life itself went its way in spite of all theories. Footnote 113, text. Oh, that little anthill! All its inhabitants are occupied with their own affairs. They cross each other's path, push each other aside. Sometimes they trample each other underfoot. I cannot be otherwise. Sometimes they trample each other underfoot. Footnote 114. We have returned with the ends to the starting point, the myth of nature. Every recollection of historical existence has now been obliterated. We are left with an apotheosis of the merely natural, of force without reason, the exodus from social reality to complete. Behind Hamsun's bitter responses to contemporary civilization lies the cold and nihilistic negation of the very image of man on the road to freedom. His characters are not truly individuals, but irrelevant particles of a human process forever beyond their control. Both as an artist and as a political partisan, he was unequal to the challenge of the great heritage of libertarian thought in the West. Page 345. Cervantes and Shakespeare, Racine and Molière, Goethe and Ibsen had this in common. All embraced the struggle of the individual with the social and natural environment. All refused to place limits on human imagination and achievement. All, with fervor and tenderness, served human liberty.